Most of the disappearances I've covered so far have been tragedies, where the missing have either been a victim of circumstance or a crime. Those left behind experienced loss. They fought to find their loved one and sometimes had to settle for finding answers instead. But there's another kind of disappearance, where the missing want to disappear precisely because others want to find them. Like, say, some of the most powerful law enforcement agencies in the world. What does it take to disappear on purpose? Starting a new life can be a romantic concept, but the truth is, it's astonishingly hard to pull off. Today, I'm going to tell you about one of the few people in recent history who managed to do it, and everyone he hurt to make it happen. I'm Sarah Turney, and this is Disappearances, a Spotify podcast. Every Thursday, I discuss a new missing person case ripped from history. I want to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. Today, I want to introduce you to a man sometimes known as Black Caesar, and who may very well be America's first true Black kingpin. After building one of the largest drug empires the world has ever seen, he fled the law in 1973 and has been a wanted fugitive ever since. His name is Frank Matthews.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
At the peak of his power, Frank Matthews ran a drug empire on a scale only comparable to mafia crime boss Lucky Luciano and Colombian cartel leader Pablo Escobar. Legendary villains in the world of organized crime. Most people have at least heard their names before, even if they don't know the details of their exploits. But Frank is different. Almost nobody has heard of him. And that's a big part of why we're talking about him today. Frank doesn't want people to know his name. He'd prefer to disappear into the margins of history. See, unlike Lucky Luciano and Pablo Escobar, Frank Matthews has never been caught, despite the fact that United States law enforcement agencies have been looking for him for 50 years. Frank's born in 1944, and he grows up in Durham, North Carolina. At a time when Black Americans are treated as second-class citizens, especially in the South with their segregation laws, Durham is unique. It's defined by Black excellence, home to a thriving Black community so wealthy and successful that, much like Tulsa, people call it the Black Wall Street. In spite of the racism and bigotry of the day, its residents have built their own opportunities since the late 1890s, and in doing so, opened doors for future generations, like Frank's. While universities around the country are barring Black Americans from enrolling, 300 of the 325 students in his high school class go on to attend college. He's not one of them, though. Frank's interested in career success, but college isn't for him. He opts for a much different path. At 16, Frank and some friends rob a local chicken farm. He breaks into the coop, grabs a chicken in each arm, and takes off down the road. He doesn't realize the farmers are watching. A few minutes later, police arrest him and take him in. When Frank goes to trial, the judge goes easy on him. Seeing that Frank has no prior record and decent grades, he tells him to shape up, gives him a slap on the wrist, and lets him go, hoping he learned his lesson. And Frank does walk away with a very important lesson, just probably not the one the judge thought. Don't get caught. Now, it doesn't take long for Frank to put this lesson to use. As an outside observer, he seemingly becomes much more of a strategist, and he uses all the tools he has at his disposal. Maybe most of all, his charm. Almost every bit of research we found on Frank highlights two of his traits, his charisma and his ambition. Apparently, everyone who ever met the guy found him charming. He's smart, reliable, fun to be around, and he has this magnetism. Based on the stories, Frank's one of those people you meet and immediately want to be their friend. And he uses his likability to climb the ranks of the underworld. At 18, he moves to Philadelphia and runs an illegal lottery out of a barbershop he owns. And he's good at it. By 19, he moves to New York City, a city where he doesn't know anyone. But he shakes some hands, rubs some elbows, and before he turns 22, he somehow manages to get a dinner date with the Italian mafia, aka La Cosa Nostra. In the 1960s, the Italian mafia has a monopoly on drug distribution in the United States. So if Frank wants to level up his criminal exploits by breaking into the drug game, he needs the mafia's permission. Now, nobody knows exactly what happens during these meetings, but for what feels like the first time in his life, Frank's charm isn't enough. They basically tell him to go bother someone else and deny him entry. Now, the Cosa Nostra was notoriously racist, so more likely than not, the decision actually has nothing to do with Frank and everything to do with Frank's race. But the rejection fuels Frank's ambition. He pivots and looks for another way in. And soon enough, he finds one. A mutual friend introduces him to a Cuban man named Rolando Gonzalez. Gonzalez serves as a mid-level drug dealer for the Italian mafia, the same people who told Frank no. But Gonzalez and Frank get along so well, he asks Frank to work as one of his pushers. He's so low on the food chain that the people at the top will never find out. Frank works with Gonzalez a few times, but in 1969, the authorities arrest Gonzalez on drug trafficking charges. Having no interest in serving time, Gonzalez flees the United States and moves to Venezuela. Venezuela has an extradition treaty with the US, but it's vague and rarely enforced, meaning Gonzalez may be able to avoid prosecution. This is another pivotal moment for Frank. For the first time ever, he sees someone escape the justice system without any repercussions. He's shown it's possible. Plus, thanks to Gonzalez, he now has a direct connection to high-quality heroin and cocaine. Now, because of the illegal nature of this business, we can't confirm exactly what happens once Gonzalez lands in Venezuela. But Ron Chepsick, author of Black Caesar, thinks it may have gone something like this. After fleeing the United States, Gonzalez uses his drug contacts in Marseille, the location of the mafia's famed French Connection, and starts importing hundreds of kilos of heroin into Venezuela. Frank then helps Gonzalez smuggle the drugs into Miami, and after that, the rest of the United States. They have to be careful, though. Their operation needs to be covert enough to avoid attracting the attention of police and the Cosa Nostra, their former employers. But they pull it off. Frank bribes flight attendants to smuggle drugs in carry-ons and hide them in secret compartments. You name it. Frank smuggles hundreds of kilograms of heroin and cocaine into the US, and in time, makes an estimated $300 million during his time as a drug lord. Adjusted for inflation, that's about $2.1 billion in 2023. And he does all of this as the first black importer of heroin in the country, which is important. See, the mafia kept their black dealers on the lowest rung possible, but Frank lifts them up, It gives them opportunities at a time when most legitimate jobs for Black Americans don't pay a living wage. And while the drugs he peddles ultimately do far more harm than good for Black communities, that doesn't change the fact that the doors he opens for people earns him their respect and their fierce loyalty. Now, at a certain point, Frank's power and influence becomes difficult to comprehend. He imports so much heroin that one of his low-level drug cutters dies of an overdose simply from breathing the air in one of Matthew's drug factories. When neighbors call the police to check on the man's health, Frank arrives and speaks to the cops. After that, the police just drive away. No arrest, no charges, no questions asked, proving that he has friends in high places. But Frank doesn't just build his web of connections through his charisma, and his success is about much more than his race. He's also notoriously generous. This one time, he lends one of his dealers $60,000. For weeks, this guy tries to pay him back, but Frank ultimately tells him that if he's broke, keep it. Another time, he offers his kid's tutor, who he barely knows, one of his luxury cars for the price of a Chevy. And of course, he bribes whoever he needs to stay quiet. Before all is said and done, Frank Matthews expands his drug business from New York to Boston, Philadelphia, Atlanta, and beyond. Altogether, his distribution network runs through 21 states and surpasses the reach and volume of the Cosa Nostra. By the end of the 1960s, Frank Matthews' only true enemies are the mafia, and he doesn't consider them much of a threat. In fact, out of spite, he builds a home directly across the street from Paul Castellano, the eventual boss of the Gambino crime family, and in doing so, becomes the first Black man to build a house on Toad Hill, this super wealthy neighborhood in Staten Island. But the Gambinos don't react well to their new neighbor. In response to building his house, the Gambinos put a hit out on one of Frank's men. The situation escalates quickly from here. Frank tells the Gambinos, "Touch one of my men, and I'll drive through Little Italy and shoot every Italian I see." And the mafia backs down. They call off the hit. Now, I can't find a record of Frank personally killing anyone, which isn't honestly that surprising. But the fact that the Gambinos, one of the most violent crime families in history, are taking his threat seriously speaks volumes about the type of person Frank can be. Not only is he true to his word, he's ruthless. And by the early 1970s, he thinks he's untouchable for legitimate reasons. At just 26 years old, he's become one of history's most powerful kingpins. And no law enforcement agency even knows his name. He has too many friends in high places and police officers in his pocket. But in time, Frank's confidence comes with a blind spot. He's so relaxed and unfazed that he doesn't realize in the apartment complex where he does a lot of his business, one of his neighbors is an NYPD detective.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's the early 1970s, and NYPD detective Joe Kowalski is standing in an elevator of an apartment complex. A man enters next to him, wearing flashy jewelry, a white mink coat, and platform shoes. He talks to a friend in a low voice until the elevator begins to move. Then the guy swears and says, "Who does he think he is? If I had a gun, I'd blow him away." Obviously, this isn't something the average person blurts out. Kowalski doesn't know who they're talking about, but he can tell the man meant what he said. So on instinct, he tails the man, all the way back to apartment 4B. After checking housing records, Kowalski learns his name, Frank Matthews. According to Frank's business cards, he's a real estate developer. But the detective does a little digging and learns that Frank doesn't have a real estate license, and his alleged company doesn't actually exist. Obviously, it's suspicious, but when Kowalski does a background check, only one criminal offense comes up. He stole a chicken back in 1960. Kowalski's flabbergasted. For a moment, he's not sure of what he's found, but he wants to find out, so he starts building a case. He surveils the parking lot of the apartment complex and notices cars coming and going at all hours of the day, many with out-of-state license plates, some as far away as Missouri. A lot of drivers carry paper bags, and there are men standing outside the building, looking like they're standing guard. Kowalski's suspicions are confirmed when he runs some of the out-of-state license plates. Most of them belong to known or suspected drug dealers. He checks Frank's phone records, and sure enough, Frank's been speaking to men who are known drug lords. But as damning as all this is, it's not illegal to carry brown paper bags or to have visitors from out of state. Despite all the hallmarks of a drug ring, Kowalski has to be patient. If he acts too soon and he's wrong, he risks becoming a mockery at the police station. If he acts too soon and he's right, Frank might find out about his investigation and become a flight risk. He could get away. Or worse, kill Kowalski so he can't talk. Kowalski spends months waiting for Frank to slip up. Then one day, he sees a man hide something near Frank's car. He waits for the coast to be clear, approaches the drop site, and finds two small packages filled with white powder. Tests prove it's cocaine. Once he adds this final piece of evidence to the rest, the license plates, the phone calls, the odd hours, the strange packages, he has the proof he needs to finally take action. He can't believe it. He found a completely unknown kingpin by chance. At some point in 1971, Kowalski takes his findings to his superiors, who can immediately tell he stumbled onto something big. In fact, they decide the case is going to be too big for the NYPD to handle, so they transfer it over to the New York Joint Drug Task Force. The task force was created as a joint effort between the federal government and city law enforcement in an attempt to stomp out drug crime. Coincidentally, that same year, President Richard Nixon declares what would later be known as the War on Drugs. As a result, Frank now has the full force of the New York police and the federal government trying to take him down. The task force begins its investigation by renting an apartment across the street from Frank. Their eyes are on him all hours of the day. They're looking for anything to build a solid criminal case against him. And as it turns out, they get a little help from the mafia. The Gambino family watches Frank's house on Toad Hill with binoculars. They write down the license plates of his visitors, then anonymously leak the information to officials, hoping to take out their competitor. Slowly, all the watching and waiting starts to pay off. Authorities paint a picture of what exactly Frank's network looks like. Turns out, he has connections in the government, too. In Maryland, a state representative gets indicted for transporting 40 pounds of Frank's heroin. In Georgia, Frank somehow knows to purchase a plot of land right before state officials plan to build a highway on it. So, right after he buys it for cheap, he sells it to the government for a multi-million dollar profit. Even though no one can confirm whether a government employee told him about the deal, it sure feels like it. No one else would have known about the highway, and for all I know, it was someone on the inside who told him federal agents were watching him. Because at a certain point, he makes it clear. He knows. this one day, Frank spots a delivery car tailing a little too close behind him as he's driving down the road. It has this conspicuously large box on its roof that's filled to the brim with flowers. He slams on the brakes to force the car to stop. And when they do, a man flies out of the flower box, slides across the hood of the car, and lands in the middle of the road. Then Frank gets out of the car and starts berating the driver. He clearly knows it's an undercover cop, but he plays dumb. He yells at the guy for, quote, hitting a pedestrian. Then he helps the other guy to his feet, the one who flew out of the box, and pretends to complain about how there's, quote, not a cop around when you need one. Frank laughs, gets back in his car, and drives away. It's not an isolated incident either. Frank goads officers into 90-mile-an-hour car chases, exchanges drugs in broad daylight, and discusses his business on what he knows are wiretapped phones. He understands authorities want to take down his whole operation and won't arrest him for small crimes. So he continues to put on a show, like he's not afraid of getting caught. He's brazen in the face of danger, hell-bent on irritating the officers tracking him, and he's willing to risk life and limb to do it. But for all of Frank's showiness, the clock is ticking, and the government's case against him is building. By September 1972, federal agents deal two major blows to Frank's distribution network. They arrest two of his top lieutenants in Philadelphia and raid one of his heroin factories. During the raid, officials get insight into the scale of Frank's operation. They seize more drugs than they ever imagined. $25 million worth of heroin. They also take weapons, notebooks, cutting-edge shipping supplies, and more than $100,000 cash, all from one of his facilities. By December 1972, agents arrest several more of Frank's top lieutenants and many of his best customers. Those closest to Frank refuse to talk. Even now, they're too loyal. But some of Frank's customers trade information for reduced sentences. Soon, the IRS acquires enough evidence of tax fraud and tax evasion, in addition to his drug conspiracy charges, to put Frank away for as many as 14 years. The world closes in on Frank, and still, he gives no indication that he's fazed by any of it, even though his hour of reckoning is near. On December 20th, 1972, federal prosecutors acquire a warrant for his arrest and begin strategizing next steps. A few weeks later, Frank arrives in a Las Vegas airport with one of his girlfriends, 22-year-old Cheryl Denise Brown, completely unaware that he's walking into a trap. Almost as soon as he gets off the plane, federal agents stop him, arrest him, and charge him with possession and intent to distribute cocaine and heroin. He's then taken to an arraignment hearing where a judge sets his bail at $5 million, or more than $36 million in 2023. It set a record for the highest bail in the history of the United States at the time. Officials are terrified Frank might flee the country. On January 13th, 1973, authorities transfer Frank from Vegas to New York to await trial. He's held at the West Street Detention Center for 3 months. Meanwhile, Frank's common-law wife, Barbara Hinton, runs his business for him. So he's still making money and can have his empire to come back to if and when he walks free. And she does this while taking care of their 3 sons and knowing he's never been faithful to her. It's an open secret that Frank has girlfriends in basically every city he's ever visited. Then on April 9th, 1973, Frank's defense attorney petitions for a reduction in Frank's bail, saying the amount is unprecedented and unjust. The judge is either sympathetic to the argument or receives a hefty bribe, because he reduces Frank's bail from $3 million to $325,000. Now, that's still more than 25 times the average American family's annual income at the time. But for Frank, it's a joke. His friends and supporters already anticipated the figure. Led by his aunt, the people of Durham, North Carolina raised the $325,000. Based on Frank's generous past, they're likely confident he'll pay them back later, and probably with interest. Frank walks that day, free to move about the world as he pleases while he awaits trial. Naturally, the investigators who caught Frank are horrified. They try to track his whereabouts, but it's not as easy as it used to be. After his capture, their superiors slash their budget, assuming they didn't need funding anymore. So now they can't afford to track him 24/7. At first, it seems like Frank's going to be cooperative. He reports to the judge regularly to prove he's still in New York. In the past, prison sentences have been relatively lenient for drug charges. If precedent stands, Frank will serve 10, maybe 20 years. He'll be out by the time he's 46 at the latest, and he could live a relatively normal life, especially with the obscene amount of money he still has stashed away. But there's a change in the air. Nixon's war on drugs has been pushing federal agencies to prosecute drug lords for up to life in prison. By the end of June, rumors spread that Frank will live the rest of his days behind bars. His life will be over. The next time Frank's scheduled to appear in court, he doesn't show.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and we love our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
In July 1973, to avoid spending the rest of his life in jail, Frank Matthews disappears without a trace, and federal agents can only confirm three pieces of information. First, he's missing. Second, he's taken one of his girlfriends with him, not his wife or three kids. And third, he probably has access to about $20 million in cash. Worse, the same traits that made Frank such a great kingpin make him nearly impossible to catch. He had the recklessness to attempt the impossible, the resources to go anywhere, the network to hide him, and the ruthlessness to do anything to not get caught. At every turn, investigators are stonewalled by Frank's network. Everyone refuses to talk. Family, business partners, friends. Some for months, others for years. When a few do decide to talk, their stories usually contradict each other. Rumors spread that Frank drove out of New York with 55-gallon drums filled with cash. Others claim he had suitcases stuffed with money. Still, others suggest Frank drove through the city saying goodbye to friends, throwing money in the air like he was at a strip club during Mardi Gras. But more reputable sightings are reported too. One of Frank's dealers, a man named Reggie Collins, claims he saw Frank at 4 a.m. on the night he went missing. Frank allegedly told him he was leaving New York and never returning. He was driving a black and white 1972 Ford Thunderbird. An NYPD detective named Michael Bramble says he spotted Frank driving a white Cadillac in New York 1 month after his disappearance. The detective pursued him, but Frank ran him off the road and then vanished again. But arguably, the most reputable claim doesn't get made until 15 years after Frank vanished. One of Frank's close associates, Donald Connor, tells the U.S. Marshals he chauffeured Frank to the airport. From there, Frank and his 22-year-old girlfriend, Cheryl, boarded a flight to Houston. He doesn't know where they went from there, but Donald says he gave Frank his draft card to board the plane under his name. By the end of 1973, Nixon's new Drug Enforcement Administration, aka the DEA, takes over the case. The agency has plenty of resources, but no idea how to spend them. They don't have any information on Frank's whereabouts. Out of desperation, 6 months after Frank's disappearance, the DEA offers $20,000 to anyone who can provide information leading to Frank's capture. The last time a government agency offered a reward that big, they were looking for John Dillinger. leads pour in. Most prove to be dead ends, but one comes tantalizingly close to ending the search. An IRS agent named Ron Taylor receives a tip that Frank Matthews is at the First Union National Bank in his birthplace, Durham, North Carolina. Agent Taylor runs to the bank as quickly as he can. He arrives and asks the manager if Frank was there. He shows them a picture, and the manager replies, "Oh, you just missed him. He went out the back way." When he gets outside, he sees a car speeding away. He missed Frank Matthews by a matter of minutes. And investigators never get that close to catching him again. Federal agents hold out hope, but Frank never slips up. As far as they can tell, he completely abandons his past life. He lets his drug empire fall, and most of his accomplices get thrown in jail by officials or killed by old competitors. He leaves his wife and kids with next to nothing. After the mansion on Toad Hill is seized by the IRS, Barbara moves into an apartment and runs a grocery store. His sons never hear from their father again. As they grow up, they fall into lives of crime themselves. One goes to prison for auto theft, another for robbery. The parents of Frank's girlfriend Cheryl have no idea what happened to their daughter. Authorities never learn if she's an accomplice, a victim, or somewhere in between. Of course, as decades pass, the rumors never go away. Frank's in the Bahamas, hiding in Durham under a pseudonym, having a heart transplant in Houston. Officials follow every lead and always come up short every time. They pursue even the most outlandish possibilities. Decades after Frank went missing, one of his closest associates claims Frank had facial reconstructive surgery, then moved to Africa, where he lives a private life of luxury. And maybe he is. It makes about as much sense as anything else. How else has he stayed hidden all this time? Today, 50 years later, the federal government is still at a loss. If Frank is alive, he's 79 years old. And apparently, if you ask around about Frank in Durham, some of the old-timers will offer words of caution. Frank might find out his name is on your lips, and he won't like it. Some believe Frank is still out there, perhaps with a different face, certainly with a different name. Maybe in a country without an extradition treaty, free from the reach of US laws. Others have suggested Frank was killed shortly after his escape. The downfall of his empire likely upset a lot of people, like the Corsican mafia who sold Frank as heroin. We'll probably never know. The reality is, Frank Matthews pulled off a vanishing act that few, if any, have been able to replicate. And that's what I'm choosing to hold on to, that there aren't more stories like his. For better or worse, Frank Matthews is one in a million. A perfect storm. Smart, cunning, charismatic, fearless, manipulative, selfish, cutthroat. A man who built an empire from nothing, and to save himself, abandoned everyone he ever loved. Thank you for listening. In the time it took you to listen to this episode, 30 people disappeared in the United States alone. Amongst the many sources we used, we found Black Caesar, The Rise and Disappearance of Frank Matthews Kingpin by Ron Chepsick, extremely helpful to our research. If you or someone you know needs assistance with a missing persons case, please visit seasonofjustice.org. Season of Justice is a nonprofit organization that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. For full disclosure, I am a member of the board. It's a great resource for both law enforcement and families in order to bring closure to those impacted by unsolved violent crime. You can find all episodes of Disappearances and all other Spotify podcasts for free on Spotify. This episode was written by Giles Hofseth, edited by Nora Battelle and Connor Sampson, research by Mickey Taylor, fact-checked by Haley Milliken and Chelsea Wood, and sound design by Alex Button. Our head of programming is Julian Bravo. Our head of production is Nick Johnson. And Spencer Howard is our post-production supervisor. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.